This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. It's lovely to be sitting with all of you this morning. And of course, we're still doing this sitting remotely, most of us. And one of the small joys of this very strange time is to be able to sit with people who might otherwise not be able to join us if we were only sitting in person. And there is some reason to hope that we'll be able to sit in person again before too long. As all of you know, I'm sure that vaccines are rolling out reasonably well, and California looks to be thinking about something closer to normal life. And so I'm hopeful that many of us will be able to come back to Jikoji in person soon. But I also hope we'll be able to continue to have this virtual Sangha as part of our practice. It's just been so nice to be able to sit with people even far away. And so again, I really thank all of you for connecting and sitting with us this morning from wherever you are. I'm going to continue in the series of talks I've been giving roughly every month, talking a bit about Zen for beginners. And today I thought I would focus my words on the topic of effort. As California starts to open up, some other temples and centers are experimenting with in-person practice. So I had the opportunity to lead a small retreat in person down at Esalen in Big Sur just last weekend. And it's a beautiful site right on the coast, founded within a year or so of when Tassajara was founded, and right around the time that our founding teacher, Kōbun Shinō Odagawa, came to America to help start Tassajara, also down roughly in that part of California. But what makes me think about this is that in some ways, Esalen is a strange place to lead a retreat, because people go to Esalen basically to relax. And while I think we sometimes think about meditation, let's say in the popular culture, it's sometimes portrayed as relaxing. I think many of us who have been practicing Zen for a while know that often relaxing is not exactly the right word, that it's not... It's not quite like, I don't know, laying around at the beach or something. That meditation takes effort. There are moments of calm and stillness and moments where we might feel completely at ease. But that there's also many moments, sometimes many more moments, of hard work. And, Buddha himself was not, particularly laid back. He was driven. He was very driven. He had a mission. Ever since he encountered the three sights of sickness, old age, and death as a young man, and then saw the fourth sight of a wandering holy man. He had worked incredibly hard to try to find the answers to life's great questions and to try to realize his own awakening. And he expected his followers to work very hard too. There are several lectures in the old Pali Sutras where we see Buddha criticizing his disciples for not putting in enough effort, for not trying hard enough. And of course, effort is one of the eight keys of the Holy Eightfold Path. He had, after all, tried living a life of almost pure relaxation and ease. That's what his childhood and early adulthood was like, living as a pampered prince. And he explicitly rejected that. He found that it didn't work. That it was very hard to find awakening in a life like that. And in the end, you know, he felt that the key, as in so many things, was to find a certain balance. To work hard, but not too hard. In many ways, this raises the question of why practice should be hard. When you describe our practice to someone, when you give meditation instruction for the first time, as I did with a group of students last weekend, it doesn't sound particularly complicated, for sure. There are some details of the posture, trying to sit upright, so forth. But the truth is, we're pretty flexible about things like posture at Jikoji. And then there's perhaps paying attention to the breath. Or trying to sit with just complete open awareness. But if you haven't tried these things before, they don't sound particularly difficult. And people are often surprised at how difficult they really are when they first start sitting. And of course, they're difficult because most of us really struggle with this issue of attention, with being able to focus our attention on anything, really. Focusing on our breath is just essentially an exercise to help us learn to control our attention. But we're so used to going through life with our attention just sort of wandering freely that learning to control it, it's sometimes described as like training a wild animal. You're trying to control something that's just not used to being controlled. Our great teacher, Ehe Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, who brought this practice from China to Japan, maybe 1,300 years before Koban brought it from Japan to America. He wrestled with this question quite a bit. He thought about it a little bit differently. Not so much why practice was so difficult, but why we even have to practice at all. after all, Buddha's teaching is that we're all inherently awakened. And Buddha's understanding of the world, the middle way, the way that avoids extremes, the Four Noble Truths, the Holy Eightfold Path, those are all pretty easy to explain. Buddha laid it all out in his first lecture, which probably lasted really no longer than I'll be speaking to you today. And so given that it all sounds so simple, and it's all a description of the world as it already is, why do we have to practice at all? Why can't we just listen to that explanation and then move on? If we're all inherently awakened, why don't we feel awakened? And Dogen's explanation was that there's a difference between being awakened and realizing your awakening. That having something and realizing you have it are two very different things. And that's easy to see in other contexts. For example, you know, you might have a disease and not know that you have it. Somebody might slip something into your pocket and you might not know it's there. So we've all had this experience of that difference. But with awakening, the difference seems to be quite profound. One analogy I was thinking of as I was preparing this talk is maybe it's, you know, a little bit like falling in love, which again is fairly easy to explain. And the subject of countless books and movies and so forth. But it's different somehow to really experience it. And perhaps it's not possible to fully understand unless you haven't experienced it yourself. And the way to have that experience of awakening, is through practice. You occasionally hear stories of people who experience spontaneous awakening. And so I suppose that must be possible too. But that didn't happen even for Buddha. Even Buddha, despite so many years of preparation and so much effort, only realized his awakening after a long period of meditation, not unlike the meditation we've done this morning. That for most of us, that prolonged effort of sitting practice seems to be the only sure way to have that experience and to have that realization. Now, as I said, the key in all this is finding that middle way. And with effort, there are, like everything else, risks on both sides. The risk of too little effort is basically laziness. We don't get anything done. And the risk of too much effort is burnout, or even sometimes, you know, injury. We lose our motivation. We might even lose our ability to continue practicing. And both of these are very real. It's perhaps easier to understand the risk of too little effort, since we've all had that experience of putting things off or not putting as much time into something that we need to in order to get it accomplished. But too much effort is also a real risk. You can burn out in Zen practice just like you can get burnt out at work or any other activity. The key is always to try to find this balance. And that balance will probably look different for different people. If you feel yourself getting burnt out at Zen practice, you can look to change your routine, maybe to change when you practice, change how long you practice. I find it's easier or more likely to feel this burnout if I'm practicing alone. And so hopefully soon we can go back to practicing in groups. But other people have the opposite experience. They get burned out practicing in groups, and for them it may be good to spend a period meditating alone. We can try cutting down the time we practice, or again, if we're used to practicing in the morning, practicing at night, or vice versa. The key is to find that balance of effort where we are continuing our wholehearted pursuit of the way, but not pushing ourselves so hard that we're veering into the sort of asceticism that Buddha found so destructive in his first years of wandering. The other risk in all this talk of sort of effort and awakening as sort of a eventual goal is it really is easy to forget the miracle of just being here now, sitting together. I often wonder how many things had to happen for all of us to be here right now, and all the things that could have gone wrong that might have prevented it from happening. Talking too much about awakening can make it sound like a faraway place. And talking too much about effort can make practice sound like some great mountain that we have to climb. But practice and awakening are also here right now. When I find myself forgetting this, I try to focus on just everything that's in front of me right now. You can do this with your eyes, just taking a moment to really see everything in front of you. I sometimes find it even more powerful, though, to close my eyes and just use my ears. And just for a moment, could be as little as a minute, to try to notice every single sound that I can hear. It might be the ticking of my watch. It might be a person in the next room. At Jikoji, it's often motorcycles going by, or birds or animals. Here in Menlo Park, it's other sorts of traffic. Sometimes children or adults walking around outside. Right now, there's a plane overhead. Sometimes it's the sound of my own breathing. You can do this at any time, in any place. Whether you're at home, at work, in traffic, in some beautiful setting like Jikoji, or somewhere more difficult. Because as much as we might want the world to change, as much as we might want to change ourselves, we can't forget how amazing it is, how wonderful it is right now. So while effort is important, effort is essential, we can't let our effort become just another distraction. Sometimes the only effort required is just the effort of paying attention to exactly where we are. That effort itself, the mere act of sitting and practicing together, is enough. So I thought I would keep my talk short today so that we could spend a little more time on questions and discussion, since for many of us, this is our only opportunity to talk to each other. And so I thought perhaps I would stop there and see what the rest of you might have to say.
Morning. I'll
Good
jump
morning.
In.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your talk, and my mind chews on this all the time. And so I always appreciate clarity, and it continues to kind of bring up muddiness. And so one of the things that I'm curious about, well, several, but the world that we navigate as lay people, as householders, and practicing this awareness, for me, it feeds the wanting mind. I want more. I should be doing this now all the time. And there's, you know, lots of things, let's say, that shows up that one has in one's life, particularly with family. Even once one is, you know, their children are grown and whatnot. And I was thinking of Coben. He was a family man. He dealt with the world. He must have dealt with survival issues. He wasn't supported by a temple. So this, and you've done work on awakening in the workplace, something like that. This tension that we work with of desires and being present, non-desire, attachment, no attachment, perhaps ego, egolessness, when, you know, in a state of stillness, it goes away. But in everyday living, which is survival, but well beyond survival, where most of us live, which I would consider more kind of the ego desires of where is enough, where is security, where is leaving it all and truly dedicating oneself. So, you know, this middle way as working practitioners or retired practitioners, but managing one's life as beings that need to survive, whatever that looks like, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, it's a very challenging issue for many of us, certainly for me. You know, I think the middle way is a deep and important ideal. But in some ways it can feel not that helpful, because the middle way can look very different depending on where you stand. So, you know, monks and nuns who are living a monastic life, maybe getting up at 4 a.m. and sitting all day until late at night, you know, they believe they're living the middle way. To many of us, that feels like a very extreme way to live. Others of us who maybe are working, or as you say, retired, raising families, maybe sitting a bit in the morning, joining events like this on the weekend sometimes, they think they're leading the middle way. But to the monks, that way maybe looks very soft. Almost getting too close to the way of a prince. And we all just have to find that way for ourselves. I really do think it's something that will look different. And I think a certain level of dissatisfaction and questioning is inevitable, and maybe is not bad, because it does mean that we are continuing to re-examine ourselves and question, you know, whether we've veered too far on one way or the other of the path. You know, coming back from this retreat I led at Esalen, it was wonderful. I really enjoyed sitting with other people again. But the first reaction I had is, I wish I could just go do like a 3-month practice period somewhere. That would really be the right thing to do next. And it's partly that I know a couple monks that are on their way to Japan in the fall, when they hope that things will be open again and are going to do a 3-month practice period there. And so I had this immediate dissatisfaction with sort of the middle way that I found, and feeling like, well, I want to try something else. And as I said, I think that tension is natural and inevitable, and maybe even healthy, because it does mean that we're questioning whether we're really on this middle way path or not. And even, you know, sitting this morning thinking how much better it would be if I could sit in the Zendo at Jokoji instead of here at my house. You know, is that just sort of my sort of ego desire to be there with these other people? And, or is it really that I would have somehow a deeper practice if I could practice in that environment? So I think there's no easy answers, I've certainly wrestled with this question of balancing practice and work and family and many things, you know, my whole adult life. And I still wrestle with it. I think in many ways, the Buddha's teaching is trial and error, that we try certain things and we pay attention to what happens. And we learn from that experience and then we try something else. And we probably never get it exactly right, but we just keep experimenting and paying attention and learning and then trying something a little bit different. And so I would say, you know, if this is something that you're struggling with, particularly right now, to maybe try some experiments, to try practicing more, practicing less, try playing with this balance that you have right now, and see whether a little shift one way or the other does feel like it's bringing you closer to this middle path. Because I don't think anyone else can figure it out for you. I think you just have to, you just have to find that balance again through trial and error. Thank you for the question.
Thank you very much for your talk, Dan. I kind of got hung up in the middle. You were talking about realizing awakening, and that made sense to me. And then when you were contrasting sort of the lazy way with the too strenuous way, I guess when you were talking about the lazy way, you said, well, with the way, lazy way, you might not accomplish anything. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, because I always kind of thought that Soto Zen was not about accomplishing anything. And so when you used that word, I kind of went, and, so I think you may be, I mean, we may be using the same word to describe different experiences, but I'd like you to talk about that a little bit and see if you can help me understand what you're trying to say with that word.
Yeah, so it's hard to talk about this, this question of practice and realization and awakening. On the one hand, you're absolutely right that we tend to think and describe Soto practice as not having a goal, not being pointed towards accomplishment. But on the other hand, that really raises this whole question that Dogen wrestled with of, so why are we practicing at all? Why not just lay at the beach? And is there no difference then between sitting zazen and laying at the beach or playing golf or whatever it is that you do to relax and when you're not trying to accomplish anything? And somehow there does seem to be a difference. Again, although there are stories of kind of spontaneous realizations, most of us seem to need to practice. And so while it may not be right exactly to talk about accomplishing something exactly, it We do realize something through practice. Something happens. Yeah, it may be a little imprecise to talk about that as an accomplishment, but it is a result of some sort of all this practice. It is this strange thing that the thing we're realizing is, of course, something we already have. But again, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. This very strong memory of this thing that happened to me a few years ago, where I lost my phone, but I actually lost it in one of my pockets. I was wearing a coat that had a lot of pockets, and I could not figure out where this phone was. And I actually ran around looking for it all over the place because I assumed it wasn't in one of my pockets. But eventually, and I got my whole family panicked looking for my phone as well, but eventually I found my phone in just one of my pockets. So how do you describe that experience? Did I actually find my phone? Because I never lost my phone, really. I had my phone the whole time. And yet my experience was that I lost it, and my experience was that I found it. It's a kind of a funny experience to talk about. And yet it's a real experience. Yes, it might be a stretch to call finding my phone an accomplishment, since it was never lost to begin with, but it felt like an accomplishment, sort of. It certainly felt different to have found it than to not know where it was. And so I think about this awakening and practice a little bit the same way. That on the one hand, yes, we are all awakened, you know, the phone is in our pocket, but we don't know that. And there's no substitute for the work it takes to find it. Until you've actually had that realization, it's almost as if you might as well not have it. But I agree with you that the language is slippery. And so we should be careful how we talk about it, because I don't want to give the impression that it's something far away, but I also don't want to give the impression that it's something that we can realize without effort. And that's the paradox, really.
And then I have a distracted mind. So my teacher one time told me in meditation, instead of focusing on your breath, but I used to get in one track mind also, OCD, and just like that also. She told me, instead of focusing, open your awareness, and whatever distraction comes up, pay attention to that. Then everything kind of becomes space opened up for me, and it became more fun. One time we were sitting in a session, and it was early morning. We were sitting in a yurt, and it was very quiet. It was intimate and it was quiet. And this bird started singing up above. And I started spontaneously laughing and crying at the same time. because it, the beauty of it, so the beauty of it overcame me. And then he said, as we're sitting, he said, because my my mind was not with the object of meditation, my breath at that instant. But he said, when you become one with the object of meditation, things come to you, or something like that. I forgot exactly. You become one with things, you know. So one of the things that you said in your talk is like this effort to pay attention, you know. So because I'm distracted most of the time, but there's infinite opportunities to come back to attention. It seems like that's the joy of this practice, you know, that there's, as long as you're alive, there's infinite opportunities. So anyway, I really enjoyed your talk, and I just wanted to hear you talk about that for distracted people like me.
Thank you. So I agree, in many ways, distractions are just another thing to pay attention to. And yeah, we sometimes think there's some right state of mind to be in during meditation. Maybe we should have no thoughts, no distractions. But I've always thought our practice is really just to notice what is. So not what we think should be. And so if what is for you is lots of distractions and thoughts, then you pay attention to those, notice those. Notice them without, though, sort of grasping them. Just notice them and then notice the next thing. You know, one of our great teachings is this teaching of impermanence, that nothing lasts forever. So these distractions will come and these distractions will go. And we sort of stay out of the way. We notice both of them. You know, we're a bystander, seeing them come and seeing them go without really interfering. And when the next thought or distraction comes, we notice that. And then when it goes, we notice that too. And in my experience, eventually we run out of distractions. But if that doesn't happen, that's okay too. You notice that. Yes, I really agree with that as a way of practicing. That, you know, this practice of noticing our breath is really just one way, a simple way, really, of noticing whatever is happening to us in this moment. I think that's a very strong practice.
I thank you. I just want to say, in long sitting, like in a session, at some point distractions do go away by themselves. But at least what I've noticed is not a permanent state. They come back again. So it's like this dance. What I'm asking is there a state that there's no distractions anymore?
Well, I think there's no permanent states of anything. That's impermanence. And so that's the funny thing. The distractions will come and go, but the no distractions will come and go. There's nothing that is unchanging. And so I think for most of us, if we sit for a long time and we continue the practice and we make the effort, we experience these moments of calm and stillness, and they can be very pleasant. But they pass too. Everything passes.
Well, One time Ben found the phone for me in Sesshin, in Jikoji. It was very embarrassing. It was a phone in my car. I was going all over, distracting people from Oriyoki, Doug, and Ben just pulled it out of the car, pulled out of his seat, between the seat, the driver's seat. It was right there. Oh, no.
Hi, Dan, and thank you for the talk. And I really appreciate talking about awakening in terms of revealing. And a teacher, a Roshi, actually, with whom I spoke this last week, Roshi Josho Pat Phelan in North Carolina. Mm. She's going to come speak to Santa Barbara, and we were talking. And we had this lovely conversation about awakening. I don't know how it got there, but it did. And one of the things she said, which I really, really, I had to get up and write it down. It was so juicy. It was, she said that awakening is intimate. And the reason it's so intimate, it's tailored to oneself, is because it's about breaking through our delusions. And that's awakening, seeing through one's own delusions. I found that really helpful because it helps answer Dogen's question, I think. You know, why are we doing this? We're already here. Why are we doing it? And I think it has to do with this intimacy of the practice, that it's in a funny way all about us and not about us at all. So I found that a very helpful way of looking at awakening.
Yeah, thank you. That's wonderful. And I like the last thing you said, that it's about us and not about us at the same time. And it's a universal experience, and it's a very personal experience at the same time. And our practice is all the same, and it's unique to us at the same time. It's very true. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us this morning, Dan, and continuing this series of talks that you've been giving. I'm really appreciating those. I was a little bit surprised at the beginning of this one when you used the word, early on, you used the word why. You ask, why is practice sometimes hard? And why is... not that commonly asked. We ask other questions: what, who, where, when, etc. But why seems to be almost like, I wouldn't say verboten, but it's difficult. It's fraught with peril, I think. Continuing on that theme, I find myself wondering, why do we always ask why? Do you have some insight into that? I think it's a rather primeval characteristic. Maybe it's a portal whereby our ancestors have entered dualistic thinking. Anything you can share on that, I would appreciate.
Yeah, I think I see somebody wrote an answer in the chat that it comes very natural to young kids. And I think that's right. There does seem to be something very natural about it. I think we're often trying to figure out sort of how this world around us works. It's a confusing world. In many ways, you know, Buddha is also trying to ask this why question. Why do we get sick? Why do we age? Why do we die? Why do we suffer? And at some level, you know, most religious traditions are our attempts to answer that somehow, to provide some explanation for why these things happen to us. And some why explanations seem pretty clear. You know, why do we get burned if we touch something hot? But others are much harder to understand. You know, why do we lose the things we love most? Why are we not satisfied with the things we have? So I'm not sure I'm really answering your question, except to say that it does. There does seem to be something very basic, as you put it, fundamental about trying to explain this world around us, trying to figure out the cause and effect. And that even Buddha was trying to do that with his laws of karma and so forth, trying to explain why certain actions have certain results. And often though, you know, those explanations are tricky and complicated. And maybe this is something that you're getting at. It's not always healthy to inquire too deeply into these whys. We should just accept the world as it is. But yeah, there does seem to be something fundamental about our desire to explain it, to be able to predict it, to be able to make sense of it. And the world is confusing and surprising. As I said, I think for many people, it's confusing and surprising that meditation can be as difficult as it is, because it sounds simple. And so why is something that sounds so simple actually so difficult? So it may be that there are times where it's not particularly healthy or helpful to inquire, but I think I certainly understand why people inquire, and I guess I certainly find myself inquiring about these why questions. Why should I sit in the mornings? Why should I wear these robes? Why should we do the chants we do? You know, these questions, at least for me, come very naturally. And even if the answers are hard to pin down, I do think asking them can be helpful and lead us to a deeper understanding. I think we're probably pretty much out of time. Thank you, John. And so maybe we should end here, and I'll let you all get on with your Sunday. Thank you again so much for joining. It really does feel like a special privilege to be able to sit with you all in these strange times. And so thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.